Moving right along, item eight. Consider to take possible action to approve the firm, to approve firm to offer labor relations and consultation services as the chief labor negotiator.
Yes. So in September, we issued the RFP for labor relations and consultation services to get a labor negotiator to help us as we go forward in being an independent entity. We received two proposals. Both of those firms met or exceeded the minimum qualifications that were in the RFP. So we brought both of them in today so that the board can interview them and talk with them. It's important that the board feel comfortable with the selected firm. So I thought it was important that you had an opportunity to see both candidates. We have conducted a reference check on both firms, and both of them did extremely well. I have a lot of comfort with the references that we received for both of them.
Now, this is going to be, they're going to do the dual labor relations and the attorney stuff, right? They're going to do both?
This would just be for the labor negotiator part. Both firms have also submitted proposals for the labor attorney piece.
Right.
But that is a different RFP and proposal process. Okay. This today is just for the negotiator part.
Negotiator part? Okay.
Yeah.
Gail, in reading the Atkinson one, the only references and the only experience were schools.
Yeah.
Did you get any references or anything beyond that as a world that they have lived in?
No. We contacted the references that they provided.
You didn't attempt to ask the references for additional people?
No, but we can ask them.
No, but we can.
Well, you can ask them certainly today.
Well, no, that would be my question. You have obviously a great deal of experience, so how do you translate that or transition to a retirement associate? What do you see as the differences? Mm-hmm. Where are the similarities? Let them tell us how they think they can do it.
So with that, I'll go ahead and bring the first firm.
Okay.
So I know they're going to come in and make a presentation, and then we'll go through the chair for questions.
Yeah.
Or you can ask them questions directly.
Well, no, but so you have some order here. You don't want to.
I'll recognize if you want to raise your hand. feel free to ask questions as you think of them. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please make
Good morning.
Yourself comfortable.
Any one of those four seats.
Yeah.
I'm not that one.
Thank you for coming in. Make the presentation. I'm not sure. Gail didn't say who was coming in first. So.
I'm Joe Wiley from Wiley Price and Radulovich.
Oh, good morning, sir.
Good morning.
If you want to make a presentation, kind of introduce yourself.
We'd be glad to do that.
Kind of go over the experience, what you kind of expect from this job to entail, and how your experience would relate to what you anticipate our needs would be. And then we'll kind of jump in with questions as they occur to us, and we'll kind of go from there.
All right, very good.
Thank you.
My name is Joe Wiley. I am the senior partner of the firm Wiley Price and Radulovich. I have been practicing for 36 years in doing nothing but labor and employment law on the management side. I got my master's degree at the University of Wisconsin Industrial Relations Research Institute, specializing in unions and collective bargaining. Decided to get a law degree, came out to California from Madison. Not a difficult move to make. Went to Santa Clara Law School and knew that I wanted to practice in the area of labor and employment law. That's why I went to law school. I worked for the Public Employment Relations Board that is charged with oversight of labor relations rules in the public sector in California for 2 years. I worked for the National Labor Relations Board for 2 years. It's charged with oversight of labor relations issues in the private sector. When I left the National Labor Relations Board, I went into private practice with the firm Corbett & Kane, and I was there about 16 years. We specialized, we did nothing but labor and employment law, representing about a third of the firm's clients were public sector and about two-thirds private sector. However, about three-quarters of my work was always in the public sector. That's where my interest was, and that's what I started doing immediately when I left the National Labor Relations Board, was specializing in representing public agency clients. Most of the clients that I represented at Corbett & Kane were Myers-Milius Brown clients. We had a tremendous number of special districts, water, wastewater, mosquito and vector, air quality districts. We did a few cities, but not a lot of cities with it. In 1996, two of my partners and I decided that the marriage between public sector and private sector didn't always work well with our other partners, since, for example, Charles Schwab would have paid $450 an hour for my time, and my public agency clients were, of course, unwilling to pay and unable to pay $450. So it created some tension within the office. So three of us who worked primarily with the public agency clients left and formed the firm Wiley Price and Radulovich, where we've continued to specialize in labor and employment law on the management side. We've continued, our practice is about two-thirds public sector, about one-third private sector. I do like to still do some private sector work. Frankly, I think it keeps me grounded, gives me a broader understanding of what's going on in the world, particularly in the last 10 or 15 years on benefit issues and what's happening with benefit issues. My practice has been primarily in the negotiating with labor unions. That is most of what I do. I do some litigation. I've tried a number of employment litigation matters, but mostly what my practice is negotiating labor agreements and providing clients advice on issues that come up after the agreement's negotiated. In 1997, a landmark bill passed called the Lockyer-Eisenberg Trial Court Funding Act, which did to the trial courts, or for the trial courts, largely what your statute last summer did for the association, which was to spring you from the loins of the county to being a standalone employer who can negotiate labor agreements. The employees work for you. In California, there were 57 counties that, effective January 1st, 2001, were not part of the county anymore and were basically on their own. Our firm was outside counsel to the administrative office of the courts in providing overall advice to the trial courts during that transition period. And we specifically represented about 20 of the larger courts in providing that advice of how to move away from the county, what to do with your personnel policies, how to write something that's more tailored to your needs, your labor relations rules, and then of course, negotiating a successor labor agreement that focuses on the issues of the new employer as opposed to being one small slice of what the county's issues were. I've continued to represent a number of courts in their labor relations. I think our firm still represents about 15 or 20 of the larger courts around the state, one of them being Contra Costa County Superior Court that we represent, Alameda County Superior Court, San Mateo, LA, Riverside, Orange, San Diego. And I continue to do a lot of work for a variety of public agencies, and our firm does a lot of work for a variety of public agencies. We continue to represent water and wastewater agencies. We represent a number of mosquito and vector control districts. We represent the South Coast Air Quality Management District, which is the largest air quality district in the country, and provide a variety of services for them. But our firm only does labor and employment law. I do know the Brown Act as it applies to labor law, labor negotiations. I do know the Public Records Act as it applies to that, but I am not the person that you will call if you've got a specific question about Public Records Act, unless it interfaces with the collective bargaining process. All we do is labor relations. We're small. We believe in a tailored approach for our clients. However, don't let our size mislead you. We're extremely responsive to our clients' needs. I will be the one who will do the negotiations. We're going to have my junior partner, Masashio Hira, back me up and be available to answer questions, but I would be the one that would be at the table doing the negotiations and interfacing with your two labor organizations I'm guessing, having looked at documents and things, probably starting in about January, you're going to be needing to get out there and get some of these things done with it. I would be happy to answer questions that any of you may have, And just want you to know that I would very much, I love what I do, and I would very much enjoy the opportunity to working with you and your staff.
Where's your main office located? Is it Oakland?
Alameda.
Alameda.
We're just right through the tube. When you come up out of the tube there in Alameda, we're right to the left there. I live in Orinda. And so for a lot of my Contra Costa clients, I try to schedule morning and afternoon meetings because it's real easy for me. It takes me about 10 minutes from my house, 15 minutes to get here. We do have an office in San Diego because we have a number of large clients in Southern California, and one of our staff, we only have one attorney in that office, and she does a lot of the work there, as well as myself. I fly down and do a fair amount of that work as well.
Joe, as I fit into the same category, what are your ongoing work plans as contrasted to retiring or slowing down?
I will tell you, I love what I do, and my health is good, and clients will give me work. I will continue to work for a number of additional years. I don't have a fixed date. I am in my early 60s. I'm 63. I would hope to work for another 6 or 7 years till I'm approximately 70. I do know, having experience with other lawyers, at some point clients are a little reluctant to give you an older lawyer work. I have not experienced that. I still enjoy tremendously what I do. So at this point, I have no fixed intention of a date of when I'm going to stop practicing.
Thank you.
Trustee.
Just on top of your head, can you give me an idea of the turnover rate for both your clients and your personnel?
We have pretty close to zero turnover in the firm. We do have one of our partners who is going to change to of counsel status at the end of the year, but she'll remain on. She's a person that does a lot of our workplace investigations. Our staff, one of our three staff people has been with us since 96, one since about 2001 or two, and then we had someone leave this summer, and we have one of our legal secretaries is relatively new in the office. We do have some client turnover. It happens. Particularly, not so much in our private sector, but with public agency clients, because there are elections. And when you represent public agencies, some people come out and go in, and clients decide they want to move in a different direction. It doesn't happen very much to us because the bulk of our clients, our public agency clients, are special districts. And as you all probably know, in special districts, there's not a lot of turnover of board members. So we have a pretty small amount. I've never counted it. I've been practicing for 36 years. I've had a lot of clients come and go. I've never really counted an attrition rate with clients.
Karen?
Good morning.
Good morning. The
two labor organizations that represent our employees, have you negotiated with those two labor organizations in your other client bases?
I have. Local 21 has a bargaining unit at Contra Costa Water District just up the road here, and I've negotiated with Local 21 there. And AFSCME has a bargaining unit at the Superior Court, and I've negotiated with the AFSCME bargaining unit at the Superior Court. I've had other dealings with AFSCME, but not nearly as much. I've had a lot of dealings with 21. AFSCME in California is not nearly as big a labor organization as some others. So I've had some interaction with them, but not a tremendous amount.
And a question that really will put you on, what would you say, as objectively as you can, you feel their, if we were to ask their bargaining leadership about you, what would they say?
Tough, but polite and appropriate, I would think. I'm tough. I take direction from my client, and sometimes that direction is not direction that labor wants to have taken with it. And I will advocate for your position, but I will do it within the bounds of politeness. They are your employees. And one of the things that I've learned with all of this very early on is that they all remain your employees, and you have to work. You have to have a working relationship with them. And I will not do anything that will interfere with that ongoing relationship that the agency has to have with its employees.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Louis.
Just a quick question. On your response, you put, for complex benefit issues, you consult with this law firm, Pillsbury Withrow Shaw. Well, give me an example of what you're talking about of a complex benefit issue.
We sometimes get, we are not benefits specialists. And while we can negotiate, I've just finished negotiating a big change in health benefits and structure for a client in Southern California. When I get questions about the Affordable Care Act that I feel that I don't have the expertise to answer, I'm not going to spend my client's time and money to learn that, because I don't, it doesn't come up that often for me. So I'm going to telephone somebody whom I believe I can call, and they can either tell me over the phone, or they can, in a very brief period of time, get the answer for me in a way. Again, you know, PEPRA, I do understand PEPRA, particularly from a negotiations viewpoint, but there are a number of, shall we say, confusing issues that are there. And so we will call sometimes and get assistance with that. We also have situations with our private sector clients where they have departing executives and issues related to their shares and benefits for them, and we'll call one of these two firms to get us assistance with respect to that. Because it is not, I am not a benefits expert. I can negotiate benefits and understand all the negotiations, but I'm not an expert in the legal issues related to benefits.
See any significant like malpractice lawsuits or complaints, grievances against your law firm you should know about?
No, we had one. It was filed by a city manager who was terminated by the city council. And my partner was counsel to the city council in terminating the city manager. And as retaliation, he filed a malpractice claim against our firm. It was filed in about 2003. It was dismissed and or withdrawn within about 6 months or a year, and that's the only one our firm has ever had.
Good morning. Good morning. With your experience that you mentioned of transitioning districts to independent districts away from other agencies, or what kind of, could you give us some examples of things to watch out for in terms of talking about that experience?
Yeah, one of the two of the particular things that are a bit of sleepers, I think, for clients that went through this were being very careful in writing your personnel policies to be sure it meets what your need is. There's going to be a real tendency to take the counties because it's already there, mm-hmm. and it's been in existence, and everybody knows what it is, and frankly, it's easy, and being human beings, that is the direction sometimes we tend to go. I would urge a very, very careful review of those policies to be sure that's the direction you want to have each of those policies go in, because now is your chance. Once you get the personnel policies in place, they can be changed, but it's hard to do that. You now have an opportunity to structure it in a way and the substance of the policies in a way that are helpful. A subpart of that is to look at the policies as to, are they easy to understand? Sometimes you've got policies, and I've seen them with clients, my goodness, they're 3 pages long and written in doublespeak, and no employee could understand them. It's hard enough for your HR director to understand them, but to charge an employee with understanding them. So it's your opportunity, too, to not only get the substance, but to rewrite things so they're written in a style and a format that's easy for employees to understand, that this is what the expectation is. Similarly, the labor and employee relations rules that you're going to have to adopt, the county will already have rules. It's easy to just take what they have and move it over and change the title page, and your two unions will be real happy with that in all likelihood. Hmm. But you need to make sure that it meets what your needs are and not the needs of what the county had, because you are such a very different employer than the county. Mm-hmm. And so I would say those are two very important things that early on you need to be concerned about. Also, there are issues, and I'm not exactly sure, I have a little bit of an idea of what you're doing with them, but there's issues about how having the county continue to do your payroll and issues related to the cost of having the county to do that and your flexibility, because there may be things that you decide you want to do as an agency with benefits that the county's folks will say either you can't do that because we won't let you, or my court clients ran into this a fair amount, we're going to charge you a lot of money to allow you to be able to do that. So fairly early on, one of the things to look at is how you're handling your payroll and then also your benefits and staying on their benefits package. The client in Southern California was the Superior Court at San Diego. They've got about 2,000 employees. The county was making their benefits a profit center for the county. Mm-hmm. And so they said, no, we can't, we're out of here. And so again, one of the things to do is to look at the opportunity to look at those changes and see where you want to go with it, although they won't be quite as urgent and immediate as the other things would be.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
John. Joe, what role would you expect to play or would you normally play in assisting us, probably inside counsel and perhaps outside counsel, in drafting these policies and manuals and operating procedures that you just described?
Typically what I would do is that I would look at them initially, have some thoughts about them, but I would ask usually to have the client, the HR person, take a shot at drafting, taking that as a base and then making the changes, and then our review for two purposes of legally, does it make sense, is it where you need and want to be, and reading it. We can, again, on your staffing, depending on how your staffing is, we can undertake to write it and do it all ourselves. A couple of things about that. One, that costs you more money for us to do it that way. And sometimes we may miss some of the nuances that somebody on staff here might have. Then once we get it working with staff in a way that we think is right, it would come to you all to say, yeah, this looks right. Let's present it to the union and let's begin meeting and conferring with AFSCME and Local 21 about the personnel policies and the labor relations rules. They are not bilateral. You don't get a signature on them typically. Is you meet and confer and exhaust everybody's discussion about it and then you adopt. They are typically not a bilateral document, unlike a contract or a memorandum of understanding.
Jerry, then Rusty.
There's probably not any typical way to do this, but what's your experience or preference, if you have one, with who is actually at the table? Are you typically joined by someone from, for lack of a better expression, management, from the client at a middle level who can advise you as to what the issues might be as they come up?
Yes, I always want to have the HR person with me, and then somebody from operations who can answer questions, because I believe in the process. I believe in the collective bargaining process. I've been doing it for a long time. It's essentially what my career has been, and I think it's a worthwhile process. And one of the wonderful things that happens with it is issues that really don't have anything to do with collective bargaining come up. Supervisor Jane is causing problems doing something with it. And so it's really helpful to have some operations folks there at the table to address them. Sometimes it's miscommunication. Sometimes it's a misunderstanding that can be cleared up and dealt with it. So I always want to have an operations person with me. And then if not the financial person at the table, certainly the financial person available to come when it's needed. Explain the budget. I can do that, but it's better, I've found, to actually have the chief financial person from the agency do that because of their much greater familiarity and more credibility in presenting it than my overview with it. Sometimes that person is on the team. I have clients where we have that person on the team. Other times it's somebody who comes in and out depending on what issues we're talking about.
Yeah, one other question. I'm not sure it's fair to ask, but given the size of our organization, do you have any idea how long the transition might take or the process for us to get up on in speed with
that? I would hope that you would have it all done, maybe except for the payroll and benefits part, because that does take longer to, I would think 6 months or less by approximately July 1 is realistic. Typically what you would want to do typically you'd want to start, I think, with the personnel and the labor relations rules and get them done first and then start negotiating a new memorandum of understanding.
Well, what going into negotiations, what are some core values that you hold other than being, you said polite and I believe you said tough, is that what you...
Yeah, advocating my client's interest with respect to it, but probably the foremost is honesty. I never want a labor organization to leave either a session or finish the collective bargaining process thinking that I've been dishonest with them. And sometimes sometimes it's not, particularly since 2008 with some of the public agencies, it's not always been an easy message. That's not always true, certainly not. But sometimes it's not, but I want them to leave with being honest, that we have given them honest, accurate information. We have responded to their questions accurately, honestly, thoroughly, and completely. Now, once in a while, it turns out the information we've given them is wrong, and that does happen. But when we gave it, we believed it to be correct and accurate information. And so probably for me, the overarching issue would be honesty. Mm-hmm. Honesty in my communications and honesty mm-hmm. with my team.
Excellent. And then one other question. not that I anticipate this, and I hope it doesn't happen, but in terms of like an impasse or not coming to an agreement, what's your experience in those type of situations?
Well, recently under MMBA, fact finding was added to it, and I have had experience with respect to fact finding. I've had tons of mediation experience. I don't know how many. I would think that maybe one time in 10 of my bargaining, we end up with mediation. And what mediation is that the parties have sort of reached an impasse and can't see how to get past it. And so the state of California has a group of people who are mediators. They really act more as facilitators who come in and help the sides work to see, can you get an agreement with it? I would guess somewhere between maybe 9 or 10, probably 10%. So I've probably done roughly 300 negotiations, 350 negotiations, so probably 35 or 40 times I've gone through the mediation process. And fact-finding for me, for my clients, because I don't do school districts, fact-finding has been around in school districts for a long time, but I don't do school districts for a lot of reasons. But we've had, both I and my partner, Masahiro Shiohira, have had three or four fact-finding cases I'm getting ready to present. We represent Hastings College of the Law, and we're getting ready to go into fact-finding for Hastings on their negotiations with AFSCME. I'm not at the table for the college, but we're putting on the fact-finding case for the college.
Excellent. Thank you.
Related to that, what are some issues that take you to impasse that you've had to do fact-finding on?
Money.
Payroll.
Money and benefits. I would say four times out of five. Sometimes you'll have issues, depending on what's happening with the employer, on subcontracting, where a union might be particularly concerned about trying to limit the employer's ability to subcontract. That could get you there. But I would say for impasse and fact-finding, easily 85 to 90% of the time it's money. One way or another, sometimes it's money in the guise of benefits and other issues, but it's usually money.
You indicated there were a number of differences or a number of reasons why you didn't do school districts. Would you describe a couple of those?
I'll be very candid about it, is that my parents were teachers, my aunts and uncles were teachers. Teachers don't get paid very well, but there is no money to pay teachers, and I find school districts to be extremely difficult to represent because of that. I just don't know that I can effectively go to the bargaining table and represent them. I have assisted on legal issues with school districts, so I've represented school districts in PERB cases, but I don't go to the bargaining table for school districts. It's just, for me personally, where I've said I don't want to do that. It's I'm not comfortable with it, so I don't do it.
The labor agreement ended, say, July or June 30th. How far back do you believe you should start negotiations?
It depends on what you say, start negotiations. To actually sit down at the table, I usually like about 90 days, roughly.
So 3 months to sit down?
Yeah, to sit down, and the first couple of sessions with it. But in terms of actually preparing, if you have an agreement that expires on June 30th, I would think by the 1st of February, you want to start working on your proposals. You want to start talking about what are our goals and objectives with the negotiations. You want your finance people to start projecting out, not just the next fiscal year, but the next two or three fiscal years. Where does the money look like it's going to go? So that when you get to April, you're pretty much set to go. You don't want to be starting the meeting and then only then starting to say, whoops, we better figure it out. So approximately February.
So you want to have your proposals done starting in February.
Start working
prior
on them and to have them done by April for that first session. doesn't all have to be buttoned up by that first session,
right.
But you want to be substantially there. It largely because in negotiations, you work backward. So you know, here's the outcome we want to get. We need to know that before we start, or at about the time we start, because it dictates how we go through the bargaining process.
Good. I see you also do interest-based bargaining. You say when may be productive. Is that prior to going to arbitration or mediation?
Yeah, it's in the bargaining process. So particularly for non-economic issues, I think interest-based bargaining can work reasonably well for it, where you've got language items, operational issues, because there is a common interest, the interest of getting the work done. I think interest-based is a lot harder on money because oftentimes the interest isn't quite an overlay with it. So yeah, it would be on language issues if the parties want to do that. I believe a lot of what I do, even when it's not technically interest-based, is interest-based. I mean, what I'm always looking for is when I'm communicating with the union on an operational issue or a language issue, what's their interest? Because I need to be an advocate, and to be an advocate, I have to know how is this impacting what they want? And by listening to them, learning what they want, even if it's not a more formal interest-based bargaining.
Gary?
There may be tactical reasons for doing this, but how comfortable are you in going back and talking to management, aside from the bargaining table, and saying, I'm not sure what the big deal is on this issue. Can you enlighten me? Why are we pushing this one?
As I mentioned, I've probably done roughly 350 negotiations, and 350 of them I've had to do that.
Yeah.
That goes with the territory, is that you're not just bargaining with the union, but sometimes the union makes damn good points.
Right.
And you need to be willing to, someone once said to me, concede the concrete is hard. And so sometimes you do need to come back and say, hey, this we're a little off with respect to this. And I'm joking about 350, but pretty close to all of them. At some point, there was some discussion like that about some proposals.
I would also make two observations. Usually about timing, my experience is if you set aside 2 months for the negotiations, you'll probably get it done in that time. You set aside 6 months, you'll get it done in that time. The negotiations will fill the time that you set aside for it.
I would agree.
And you'll spend 95% of your time talking about these issues, about Helen does this and Frank always does this, and eventually you get down to the last week and you do the money and the benefits.
I would not disagree with that. And typically in the first month, I'll meet maybe twice, once every other week. The second month, we'll meet maybe four times. And then in that last month is where most of the work gets done. The trouble is that you can't, it's like a dancer on top of a pressure cooker. If you say, okay, well, if we know that, then let's condense it down to a month, or let's condense it down and do it. And the problem is you're holding that pressure cooker top down. And this is an opportunity for employees to have industrial democracy and to voice their views and their opinions about things, and for you to hear what they have to say. And so I think it's important. I don't find any advantage to 4 months. Sometimes at about 2 months, we're starting to jam it up a little bit. So my experience has been roughly 3 months. Seems to work pretty well.
Okay. Any other questions? Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And again, I would leave you with, I would love to work with you, would love to work with your staff, and thank you very much for asking me to come in today.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, that was exciting.
We had no idea whether it was going to be first or last.
John, can we pry? What are the congratulations for?
His daughter won.
My daughter ran for city council in Orinda and came out number one.
Oh, my God. Oh, congratulations. I wasn't following the Orinda's returns.
That's awesome.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah,
that's great.
No, it was exciting.
So now she can worry about how to pave the roads.
John will have all his potholes.
Yes, right. He's going to have a three surface around it.
In fact, I put that in this morning's email.
just make a comment before we go to the next person? Obviously, we have several county employees around the table who've been involved in negotiations. I personally think, whoever we select, that because for one thing, we only have two labor organizations, and I think as we go through the collective bargaining process, we will find out. But I know from my other hat that a lot of the issues, and you all lived through this, I wasn't on your board at that time, was about how the county cut back, and this was a separate organization. So in addition to all the work that will need to be done on changing policies and procedures, one of the issues that the county faces, and Lou's been through this and Will's been through it, is sometimes negotiations are staged by bargaining unit because we have so many of them, is my point. And Brian's part of the deputy DA. So when the questions come up for our lay folks as to how long negotiations take, I'm hoping that they don't take as long because there's only two groups. And they pretty much, they're not competing against each other. What we hear is, well, why did one bargaining unit get a better deal than another bargaining unit? And they did that last time. So we want to wait till last, and you do everybody else first. So, you know, I don't think we're going to have that issue coming up. So It's a valid question and a concern about that. But I think we're going to be fortunate here as the employer that we're not going to have dragged out negotiations, whoever we select. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, with the Christmas season coming up, you still believe in Santa Claus?
No, seriously, Jerry, and I appreciate
you. Well, I hope you're right, too. No,
because it is about benefits and wages. That's what I heard on the other side about the lawsuit of why the separation was, is that this board wanted to set those policies. And while he had some concerns about the payroll system and whatever, I didn't want, and Rusty would know better. I mean, you can't charge by law more than the administrative costs that it costs. So I'm not sure why San Diego was looking at it as a profit center or could get away with that.
Well, the incentive for the county here is to keep our costs down because our costs,
Absolutely.
Whereas with the court systems, it's the state versus the county. So, whatever.
Well, the last one we negotiated was a year and a half. So,
yeah,
the one I was involved in.
And I just don't see that being that many issues.
Yeah, and it goes both sides too.
I mean,
it's not just employees. The employees too. Well, hold it. We want to slow down because see what the other people get. I mean, that's
inevitable. That's always going to be that way.
Public knowledge, I don't think, we're in bargaining with California Nurses Association, CNA, our nurses at our hospital. And we've been in negotiations. I think the contract ended either July 31st. Yeah, July 31st. They haven't put any monetary things forward because they're waiting to see about what's going to happen with Kaiser. Because that's the big, bargaining thing. And it's just interesting to me as an employer that none of it's going to be retroactive. And so, whatever. It's just, so that's one reason bargaining slows down.
Absolutely.
Is one side or the other, there's no incentive to move forward until something big happens. Mm-hmm. I don't see that happening here.
Okay.
So next we have Chet Quaisley and Todd Galuba from Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rudd, and Romo.
Could we call them Atkinson from this point on?
Please don't make me.
They're headquartered out of, I was trying to figure out where they're.
The office in Pleasanton.
Pleasanton, mm-hmm. Okay.
Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Here?
Please make yourselves comfortable.
Thanks. I'm Chet Quaid, and this is my partner, Todd Galuba, from Atkinson, Andelson, Loya.
Good morning.
So you get from Chesley, you go Chet, right?
Chet, yeah. It's it's always worked,
Okay. We're very informal. Go ahead and introduce yourselves, your firm, what services you provide, how you think you can best serve our needs from what you know of us. We're jump in and ask questions and when something occurs to us, and we'll kind of go from there.
Okay. Maybe for an introduction, you guys hopefully had a chance to look at the materials.
We
consider ourselves to be, you know, the best of both worlds in that we're from a small local office as part of a large law firm. And the ability to provide services, both Todd and I have been dealing now, made a preface. We submitted two proposals to you for two different areas, one for negotiations, one for labor relations, I'm sorry, for just personnel and labor work. I began working in negotiations when I went through law school. I worked my way through law school as a truck driver. I was an AFSCME. I became a union steward. And then when I graduated law school, I worked 2 years for a law firm in San Francisco representing firefighters, police, carpenters in Myers, Mills, Brown negotiations and other matters. So I had that before I came over to Atkinson Adelson, which was 24 years ago. I've been at that firm ever since. Todd's been at the firm 21 years, where, you know, part of why we're both here is to show that we are a firm and the ability to serve you, what that types of resources provides to you. And for 21 and 24 years, we've been involved in negotiations with public entities, mostly school districts, but some other ones, in the East Bay and throughout Northern California. And throughout that time, we've worked with a number of clients. We've worked together on a number of times with a number of clients. We've both served negotiations. We have some clients we've had for 20, 21 years. We've done negotiations for consistently and throughout the time. We've developed some long-term relationships with the people. Part of if we're doing negotiations work, the big thing that needs to be impressed upon people is the relationship built at the table, and the relationship we have with the unions and their reps. And what makes for good negotiations and good relations is having long-term relationships. We gave you a list of some of the clients we've worked with. We could have given you a list of union reps who we've worked with over the years and have always been able to accomplish the goals that the employers required, but as part of that, always prided ourselves in maintaining very good relationships with the reps themselves and also with the unions, because in order to have a good, effective relationship, you need that. I mean, you open the newspaper every day, you see situations where there are not good labor relations and how that can poison the whale. You know, granted, there may be some tough issues you have to deal with. We've dealt with some tough issues, but we've always done it in a way that's professional and always maintain good relationships with the people we're negotiating with. A little bit of background on the firm. We may not represent it today, but if you read the materials, you'll note that California Lawyer Magazine has named us the last 3 years as the most diverse law firm in the state of California, as far as minority and women partners. And if we work with you, you'll meet some of those people. Irma Moises down south is part of the response to this materials. You know, and that's based on how many partners we have of people of color and also women. We've been ranked 3 years in a row as the most diverse law firm in the state of California. We're also diverse in the services we provide. We're a big firm, but with a small office, what that means is we have experts in every area if you need one. Now, granted, you guys have a general counsel who does most of the stuff, but even for labor relations, we have experts in specific areas where if we need that expertise, we can call upon it. For instance, I've come to the Hill as the firm's expert to do with the Affordable Care Act. You know, I've been doing workshops up and down the state. That's something that you guys will have already been impacted by. What's scary is how slow I think a lot of agencies have been on the uptake about, you know, recognizing the need to understand the Affordable Care Act and how it impacts them. But we have other people in other areas of negotiations experts who we can call upon if needed. So I think part of our strength is our diversity, not just in who we hire and our makeup, but also the people and what their backgrounds are and what they bring to the table, and what are resources for this body if you need them.
Well, I was starting to feel like Teller and Penn and Teller here. So my name's Todd Galuba, and as Chet indicated, we've literally been working together, serving clients jointly. You know, we're both partners now. At one point, we were both associates in the firm. And so what you're getting is you're getting a real team approach. And although only one of us would likely be lead in labor negotiations, you know, suffice it to say that if in the unusual situation that you can't get a hold of one of us, you know that you've got a backup that you can get a hold of. And I think that's one thing that you'll really experience with us is that we're very responsive, both of us. I mean, we're always carrying around our handheld devices, and whenever you need to talk to us, you're going to be able to talk to us, you know, most likely within the hour, if not within the morning or within the afternoon. You know, providing, you know, great service is something that we really excel at, and I think you will really experience that with us. In addition, I just wanted to echo what Chet said, which is that if I were sitting in your place right now, where you are becoming the employer for the purposes of the Myers-Milius-Brown Act for the first time, and you're realizing, okay, we're going to have a different role, a more direct role in regard to labor relations. You know, what you really want is you want continuity. From what I was able to tell doing research is that the labor relations with both of your both of the employee unions who will be the exclusive representatives appear to be positive. You have agreements that stretch for the next two and in another case the next 3 years, and so your interest is maintaining those positive relationships. And as Chet said, we could have put references for the representatives for the unions that work with us. Have a long track record of successfully leading our clients to an agreement. We know all the phases of the process: mediation, fact-finding, and even unilateral implementation and strike. But rarely do we ever have to get to those the end of that process, because almost always the process ends in agreement. And that's really what you want when you're considering hiring counsel. You want somebody, you want a firm that's going to maintain harmonious labor relations, and we would definitely do that.
Any questions?
Jerry?
Have you ever had instances in which you lost a client one way or another because of the two hats you're tending to wear? Let me give you an example. That someone says, hypothetically, I see that the CICERA negotiations are not going too well, and we understand from our buddies over there that you guys are taking a hard-ass position with CICERA management, and your relationship with us as a labor union is in jeopardy because of that. We want you to lighten up. Ever seen any problems with those, or a possible conflict?
We've never had any issues. I mean, that's kind of known as a Littler syndrome in our end of it, where a firm has a reputation for very hard dealing, and that may adversely impact them at other tables or in other relationships. Mm-hmm. It's never happened to us. You know, everyone loses clients from time to time, but we've never had an instance where something like that's been an issue.
One of the things I can think of is that we work closely with our board that's providing the parameters, and one of the things we always do is make sure to prepare the board for all of the union-related tactics that may come to play later on in the negotiation. And so in that way, by managing the expectations of the board, that these are just actions out of a playbook designed to put pressure on the board in ongoing negotiations, you know, we really help prevent the board that we're working with from being persuaded by the union tactic of what's called bash the negotiator. And so I think we've been successful, not being fired by clients because we've been able to effectively manage expectations of the boards that we work with.
How much of your time is spent in negotiations and preparing for negotiations as contrasted to other kinds of services?
I think I would say probably about 25% of my time is negotiation related, rather either in negotiations or preparing for negotiations or dealing with spinoff issues of negotiations, typically 1 to 2 days a week. And it's picked up recently because there's, with a semi-rebound in the economy and the public sector is having some more money. For a couple of years, people used to say, trained monkey could say no. We don't need a negotiator, there's no money. So there wasn't that much business for negotiations. Now that there seems to be more money in the pipeline and more pickup, the negotiation work's coming back some. I'd say in my time, maybe 25% of my work is involved some form or another in negotiations.
Yeah, the number I usually say is 30. So it's about the same for each of us. The other role that both Chet and I tend to play is we're usually both the general counsel, which includes labor and employment for a public entity, and then we do the labor relations. So we are usually the kind of the leads that are handling the most important matters for both the board, the CEO, and also the negotiations. So, like for instance, the two large Contra Costa based public entities that I serve as the general counsel for are Contra Costa Community College District and West Contra Costa Unified School District.
Trustee,
can you speak to your experience you've had with working with an organization like ours, as to
become independent here fairly soon, starting from ground zero, and what recommendations would you give to an organization like ours, and some caution?
Well, you guys are obviously fairly unique. I think an analogy we could have is a lot of the clients we work with are school districts, and I've worked with brand new school districts, about 10 of them that have been formed, either unifications or other actions, where all of a sudden there's a new entity, and you're starting with pretty much a blank slate, although the law says we have our old contracts that we have to maintain terms and conditions until they get renewed. So to that sense, I think it's a good analogy where we've had to come in with basically a brand new entity and begin on the ground floor, you know, with the negotiation process and building relationships. And, you know, granted, I went and looked at those contracts you guys are a part of. I bet you no one here played a part in negotiating those contracts, and I bet you none of your employees were probably on any of those teams that negotiated those contracts. So they're countywide. I mean, they're dealing with issues from a big perspective. And what you're getting now is a chance, as you become your own employer, public entity, is to have contracts reflect issues you're dealing with and needs you have and your employees. So it's going to be a big change. You know, I was reading that and I was seeing like sheriffs, dog catchers, you know, you were thrown in there. But now you're going to have ultimately labor contracts that address, you know, roughly 40 employees in the units and concerns you have as a board, saying there's some things we need that may not have been reflected, you know, in that big master contract. So that sense, I think we've had good experience with starting with a clean slate and negotiating a contract, helping negotiate a contract that works for your needs and your employee needs, because your local employees are going to have issues that were never on that calendar, you know, when the unions negotiated a countywide contract. So in that sense, starting from scratch, building a good contract that, you know, meets the needs and your interest as well as your employees, it's kind of giving birth. I've never done that, obviously, but I've negotiated contracts for the first time, and it's a very important phase to go through to build a good bedrock for future employee relations and labor relations.
Yeah, your employee unions will definitely fear, you know, instability. They'll take comfort in the contracts as they exist, and I would anticipate that they, you know, will want to protect as much of what's in that contract as possible. You do have settlements going through the end of these contracts, so we've got to, you know, any changes that are going to be made to those contracts in the next couple of years are going to have to be, as far as I could tell, with mutual reopeners where both sides want to negotiate something. You know, in particular, you know, negotiating alternates to the merit system provisions, which you will no longer be part of the county merit system, so that'll need to change. But I would just really look forward to having a dialogue with the employee unions about, you know, I always get excited at this point, you know, because it's like, okay, now we can create something that each of us owns, because that's really what a labor agreement is. It's, and what the employee union should want is they should want to take ownership of this document and make it live for them and address their interests. And so what I would be hopeful is that over the next couple of years that each of your employee unions would share that interest, and we would start to remake these contracts so that they would fit your entity rather than the county-wide contracts that exist now.
On that note, do you have experience working with any of these two labor units in Contra Costa County?
No.
Not at all?
Not in Contra Costa County, okay. But AFSCME I've dealt with before, and I know Chet has as well.
But, yeah. But not local, the 2700, no, we haven't.
Right. Or local 21? The
professional?
Yeah.
No, I've never worked with Local 21.
Yeah. Typically, you know, the unions that I have the ongoing relationships with are CTA, obviously, AFT, Local 1, as well as CSEA. My experience is that, you know, I have good relationships with every union that I work for, and so I wouldn't see, it's going to be a new relationship, sometimes, you know, the baggage that goes with having had a negative relationship with a union, to bring in a breath of fresh air, to bring in somebody who has a track record of successful relationships with multiple unions, can be a benefit. So I would say that, lack of specific experience with a union isn't necessarily a negative. It could be a positive.
Yeah, and I know. I'm just wondering if you're familiar with any of our baggage here in Contra Costa.
No, we're a breath of fresh air.
But
So just to be clear, who would be at the negotiating table? Would both of you?
I would be the lead. I would be the one. Yeah.
Okay. And then in your absence, would he?
Yeah. And if you needed, and Todd's here as a partner, say if something came up, you couldn't get a hold of me, you needed something, mm-hmm. some information, you know, that's part of what we bring as a firm, and that's why we're both here today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sort of different from sometimes you have a labor negotiator that, you know, is very busy and is just themselves, and that's very different to work with one person than it is to work with a whole team of lawyers. We access all sorts of resources. You know, I don't have to know the Affordable Care Act as well as Chet does, because I can just go to the expert on that. And so we're really, you know, you save a lot of time in research. You can really leverage the knowledge of an entire firm when you choose to go with more of the team approach.
Mm-hmm. Not that anyone anticipates this, nor anyone hopes for this, but what's your experience with impasse or, you know, coming to no agreement?
If you look at materials, we've all multiple times been through impasse. 95% of the time you come to an agreement at impasse. In my career, 3 times I've been with an employer that has unilaterally implemented its last best offer, meaning basically we're done with the process and we're going to implement. And through those times, we've done that and yet maintained good relationships with the parties. Very hard to do, but it can be done. I mean, basically getting to that point where there's no more negotiations, you've gone through impasse, you've gone through fact-finding, and then the law provides that the board can unilaterally implement its last best offer if it chooses to. I've done that 3 times. It's not necessarily pretty, but we've done it, and we've limited any collateral damages where we still, ultimately, the following year, we had better relations, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. You know, it's obviously not something you want, but we're experienced at it if we have to go there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would add that, now that cities, counties, and special districts are under the jurisdiction of PIRB, you get the same mediators that that have always worked for school and community college districts. Those are the mediators that that I've worked with over the years, and in particular, you know, the mediator that would likely be assigned to this to the association, you know, be Tom Ruiz from California State Mediation Conciliation Service, who I work with closely when I served as the interim general counsel for San Francisco Unified. So one of the things in impasse is you do want to have a good relationship with the mediator, and we have those relationships.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
What is your bargaining approach to economical and non-economical issues? Do you use a traditional or interest-based or...
We're both trained in interest-based and have conducted it. From my perspective is, if there's a buy-in for interest-based, it can work. Sometimes it's interest-based until we talk money, and many times it kind of breaks down because money is core interest to everybody. So, you know, we're both trained in interest-based bargaining. We're both certified to do that. I've worked with it in a few times where it's been effective. Most times it's been my experience that it works good for non-money issues, but when you get to money issues, sometimes it just collapses and it gets back to traditional negotiations, because it's very hard to handle money issues through interest-based, because it's kind of like the
right,
core interest.
Right. Okay.
So it's there as an option, and it takes commitment from both parties.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And having served, you know, from a bargaining team, from a union perspective, I've had times where part of the team was more committed than the others to it, and it just, if there's a good buy-in, it could work. But other than that, it's more traditional. Typically, we find that non-monetary issues go first. When I was a union rep, we used to say, we need to keep our parties interested in the process, so take care of everything else, and then settle money last, because otherwise, if you settle money first for your members from a union perspective, they're going to lose interest. Okay, they got their raise, though. So that's the way typically negotiations will go, is you handle the non-monetary issues and then the monetary issues, in either interest-based or traditional approach.
Yeah, and I always consider it, you know, interest-based bargaining is a tool that we can pull out of our toolbox, and oftentimes I'll, bring that up and say, shall we use that tool for this particular article? And frequently that works out really well. I do a lot of work on whiteboards and on sheets of paper, and, you know, I'm a real visual person, and I find that brings, a lot of clarity to the table. I like to leave charts up for members of the other union bargaining team to keep seeing, so that the information sinks in. And I also believe that putting a lot of information on sheets of paper or on whiteboards, where we take photographs of it and then distribute it out, that I always think of negotiations as a story, right, with a bunch of different chapters, and it's important for those chapters to remain accessible to the bargaining team so we can go back and say, what happened on, you know, November 5th, 2014, and we can just like in a book where you can flip back and reread a chapter. I find that useful in getting to a settlement to remind the parties where we've been.
In the past year or so, how many times have you guys been the lead negotiator at a district that's not a school district?
I've been non-school district. I've been with the County Office of Education, which is technically a different. It's not a school district, but it's akin, you know, it's a non-necessarily teaching role, but it's an administrative body that oversees school districts. I've been there, but non-school districts, it's been since last time I was, when I was with the union side law firm.
Yeah. So that's a big choice for you, is that, one thing that we typically work with county offices of education, school districts, and community college districts, and you're not one of those. Okay, so, but, you know, negotiations are negotiations.
And, well, that's true, but at the same time, we're not up against our statutory limit in terms of expenses and everything. So it's different being the employer saying, we won't give you this, as opposed to a school district where a lot of times their finances, it's like, we can't give you this. Mm-hmm. So I view it as a pretty substantial difference.
Actually, almost all our negotiations, there's not an inability to pay issue. I mean, that's the hardest things. Even when during the bad times, we seldom made the argument, we can't afford to pay that. You know, we'd have to make the argument in contention that no, is the board doesn't think it's realistic to do. The board is concerned with fiscal solvency. But very often, that's a tough argument legally to make if you go to impasse and find yourself in front of a fact finder. To make the argument that you can't afford to is really a very high standard to meet. So we never would really make that argument. Maybe I had one district that was almost insolvent. We made that argument successfully. But basically, you're kind of having to deal with the same issue before. We have money available, but you know, there are different interests. We have different interests. You know, employers are one part of that, but we don't believe that is necessarily as much as you guys, the unions, want to put on there. So it's, I think it's fairly common in that sense. And secondly, since all the MMBA, Myers-Mills-Brown Act, was shifted to PERB, that's the whole process we've been doing for 25 years, where we know the mediators, we know the administrative law judges, we know the processes. You guys now go through impasse where it didn't exist before, which we're very familiar with. So admittedly, we haven't worked with a lot of, two of us haven't worked with a lot of special districts. We have some other attorneys who have, not necessarily in the Pleasanton office.
Karen.
Given that, and I don't want to give you the answer ahead of time, but why did you want to respond to our RFP, other than what I would, you know, everybody wants to expand their business. What about our RFP was attractive to you, as it was outside what I would consider your area of expertise?
A couple of years. One, it was exciting.
Was the what?
Exciting, because you're a new employer.
I see.
It's something different. It's you're 24 miles away from our office. You know, obviously we feel it's the work we do, we believe we're very good at. One thing, if you notice, we're all over the state, if you read our references.
Why I'm asking, because you have a lot of expertise in the school area.
Well, and physically. I mean, it's not uncommon for us to drive an hour and a half, sometimes 2.5 hours, because we cover almost all Northern California. And between you guys being a new employer, between you guys being 24 miles from our office, and you know, as part of the negotiations, we also applied to do the general labor work. We saw it as an opportunity, something that we could, you know, hopefully provide services that would be appreciated.
Yeah, and I mean, I can echo that. You know, it's not. I mean, I always look at these relationships as it's not about us; it's about you, right? You're the client. You're making a selection, mm-hmm. Okay? And so you have to figure out, you know, among the choices presented, you know, who is going to serve our needs the best? And I think we would posit that, you know, given our track record of success representing school and community college districts, that why not? Why wouldn't we have the same amount of success with you? All the rules that pertain to negotiation. When I look through, you know, the the articles of your contract, they look exactly like the articles of a contract of a school or community college district. These are issues that we know very well, the difference between, you know, what you, the labor relations issues that you have with your employee unions are not very different from the labor relations with school and community college districts.
Law firms specialize, and, mm-hmm. and my first career was as a legal secretary. So, you know, I did family law, and then I was in an insurance defense firm, and they were in the same firm, and there were always tensions within that firm of who made more money and should we branch off here or there. So I was sort of, that's sort of where the genesis of that question came
from. And I'll just add that we, within our firm, we do have an entire practice group that's devoted to cities, counties, and special districts. And Irma Rodriguez-Moisa, who is listed as the lead, not for the labor negotiations, but for the sort of labor and litigation, she's the leader of that group. And so Chet and myself, that group works very closely with our public school district group. We just don't have anybody from that practice group out of our Pleasanton office that could serve you locally. And we didn't want to present somebody from, you know, Los Angeles.
No, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Gary, the rest of you.
A good lead, and I think there's a possibility that that we could split this business. So I can see some advantages to a one-stop shop. I can see some advantages to the other side. So if we were to split this business, would that be an impediment to the relationship we might have?
Let me turn to Todd. Todd was the interim general counsel for San Francisco Unified for a while, and his job was to supervise all the lawyers that were hired by this San Francisco Unified School District. And there are benefits to do that. Well, go ahead, Todd. I'm talking too much.
Oh, so benefits for you to work with multiple law firms, right?
Benefits for working with multiple law firms.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Okay. I mean, that's right. What Chet was saying is that at one time I was in the position of like being where you are, that I was the manager of all these different law firms, and so I could see, the benefit of, you know, certainly of having choices, right? Because if you're just working with one law firm, you need a second opinion. Okay, you've got a second opinion right there. And that when law firms know that they're in competition with another law firm, okay, in other words, that there's two different firms serving one entity, that keeps both the law firms on their toes because they want to provide you with the best service possible. Because they know that if they don't, there's the other law firm that you have a relationship with that could get all of the business. So I think it's if you are considering, of course, we always like to do all the work, but if you're considering splitting it, that could be to your benefit for that reason.
Many of our big clients have multiple contracts with different law firms. They tend to find for expertise or likes in certain areas where they'll contract, you know, specific projects. We're used to it. You know, we are full service, we like to be, but we've existed many times as being one of multiple law firms providing services to a client. And there are benefits to you guys, too.
Thank you.
Rusty? No, that's mine.
Okay. Louis?
If a contract expired June 30th, how far would you start getting ready for negotiations and sitting at the table?
I think what I'd like to do is the fall before, at least talk to them, sit down and have some meetings with the managers, with the board, and say, okay, what are the goals? You know, we don't want to start and run late. I like starting late fall for the following year because you don't want to be left in limbo once your contract expires. Although legally it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, but I like being prompt, determining what the interests are, you know, what the hands are. The people who supervise the unit members. What are their issues? What are their concerns? What do they want to see to make their job easier to supervise these people, and to formulate the initial proposals and hopefully get to the table. I like to at least 5-6 months before the contract expires, because you don't want to be seen as untimely. If you come late, then you're always going to be subject to the charge that, you know, the union is saying we're working without a contract, and that's not necessarily the good publicity you have. And if times get tough, we've worked without a contract for X months, for a year, year and a half, I see in some cases. So, you know, part of what we would hope to bring is the planning process, how to get our interest at the table, and how to begin that process sooner rather than later, so that we're on top of it. You know, sometimes negotiations can tend to get out of control for any number of reasons. One of them is timing, where I think you start too late and you're not prepared.
And how long do you think it would take to negotiate a contract, or what are you looking at, or what's your average for when you negotiated other contracts?
Well, I'm looking, you guys have 42 units, 40 represented employees. Now, looking at your two unions, you know, how interested is Local 21 going to be in six employees? They may just want, they may come and say, I just want to meet you. Just live under our old contract. You know, we'll have to say, well, the parts of that are inapplicable, you know, because they're not going to have any interest in serving. I mean, not to bring it down to economics, but they're going to say, we've got six dues payers here. Are we going to send a negotiator and negotiate a whole contract for them? They probably won't have an interest in negotiating extensively. Maybe we can do, you know, maybe we possibly do a quick one. We would have interest in getting in there, issues and interest that we have as opposed to the county. So maybe sometime. I think that would go fairly quick. As far as your other one, as far as your AFSCME, you know, 33, that's a relatively smaller unit too. So I would think, unless there's some huge, as we call it, baggage or something, that it wouldn't take a whole lot of time. I think I've had several smaller employers that 2-3 sessions is all we need. Now, granted, you're starting from scratch, but for instance, you go through your contract, your leave articles, you can almost just copy those immediately, unless there's some unique issue here. I mean, leaves are covered by law, and aspects of, you know, how is sick leave, do you get a note, whatever. Some of those can be copied. Some of them will require some more, but I don't see more than a couple negotiation sessions unless there's some baggage. And I had a question about that. I noticed a couple months ago that you guys asked the county to give the AFSCME unit a raise, and they turned around and said no. And other than not being able to read into it, I saw that, so that's unique. And you know, I don't know whether there's a story behind it or not, but
yep, there's a story behind it.
Okay. Well, you don't worry, we're not interviewing the story.
No.
You have the right to remain silent.
Just so you know, I'm on the Board of Supervisors, and we had to make cuts. So it's been interesting, both with your interview and our previous applicant. They're going to want to reopen those and get money back in right away, because we had to make cuts, and because we represented everybody, the county did not think it was fair to bifurcate off a small section of employees represented by the same bargaining unit. And there are arguments pro and con as to why that happens, but there have been cuts.
Okay.
And so when we started, so that's what the history.
So politically, from a county perspective, they could say, why should we give this one part of the unit an increase?
And well, it was the same bargaining unit,
yeah.
both Local 21 and AFSCME.
Okay.
So I think that's the reason that we split off, that the Sarah split off, is they wanted to handle their own negotiations.
Okay.
It's a different financial base.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad you're able to. Yeah.
Two kind of related questions. Who is typically, or who do you like to see at the table with you representing management, skill set-wise? Is it the HR person at every meeting? Is it periodically a financial person? I mean, you want some continuity, I assume. And then the related question is, when you come back from one of those negotiations, and unless there's a tactical reason for doing this, how comfortable are you confronting your key contact and saying, why is that a big deal?
Yeah.
Why are we making an issue of that?
I think Todd maybe answered too. I like having three people typically, if nothing else, the HR person, a fiscal person, and maybe a frontline supervisor. People who know the stories. A lot of times you hear claims, you hear, this happened over here, and we're clueless. I always like having someone from the front line, a manager, supervisor, as well as a fiscal and the personnel person. Now, many times you guys are small enough, your HR person might know the stories, so it may not necessarily have that frontline supervisor. But, you know, Todd, you want to throw something else in there? Or maybe about the conversation, we have to talk with someone and say, what is up with this? And everyone's human. That happens from time to time. We have to say, what is the issue here? And, you know, whenever that person is, we have to come back to the board and say, oh, here's where the issues are, here's where we are, and this is a concern raised by the team. And, you know, that's a massage issue there. How do we deal with it if it's one person on the team who's saying, taking a position that may not be in the board's best interest? And it always comes back to what we always say, we're hired by the board and we have to represent the board. And if that means calling someone out or an issue out, we have to do it, because from our perspective, that person doesn't hire us. The board hires us.
Thank you.
I would say typically after every bargaining session, we debrief with the CEO, and that we understand that this is a fluid process, and that you may start with a set of expectations and a set of directions and parameters, but depending on what's going on in the negotiation, those typically change. And so, you know, we often say that it's, you know, sometimes the hardest work is negotiating amongst yourselves as opposed to negotiating with the other party. And I think that's an important skill set, is you have to, you have to work together as a team to, and the team includes not just the bargaining team, but it includes the CEO and ultimately the board, to you know, to come to a negotiated agreement. And I think that's part of the fascination of the process and why it works so well is that you're basically negotiating in two directions at all times, and that the skill set of your labor negotiator, you want that person to be able to you know, move not just the other side, but also provide insight that will and advice based upon experience that will move the board to come to an agreement as well. Both tasks are important.
Thank you.
Will?
Chet, what are some core values you bring to the negotiating table in terms of representing us as the board?
For core values, for representing you, one is trustworthiness. It's the ability to sit down, go talk with the board, prepare for negotiations, understand our mission, determine what our interests are, and then follow through with that, and do so in a manner that's respectful and dealing direct with the employee representatives and building those relationships. I always found that the toughest negotiations I've had is where there's not a relationship, where you can't build a relationship with the employee representatives. And what happens then is you just have things blow up for any reason, things that don't make sense. So it's coming in there, representing the employer with our interest, but then pursuing those interests and building a relationship with the team that you're negotiating with. Because absent that, all sorts of bad things can happen. So I think the core values are knowing what we're going to pursue it, but by doing so, building good relationships and working relationships. Working relationships are different than people don't have to like me, but to work with me and respect me and know that I'll be direct and honest with them, and that, you know, I don't play games, and rather I'm very direct at the table. I'm saying, here's the position, here's our interest, you know, let's talk about it. And I think that's it builds long-term relationships, which end up being very effective for the employer.
And I would say that one of my core values is never getting out in front of my parameters. So always honoring and sticking to the parameters that I have from the body that's giving me direction. my success as a negotiator and my longevity as a negotiator is directly related to that. And then, you know, when I'm interacting at the table, I always strive not to make it about me. I often give credit to ideas to the other side, and I always listen to what the other side says, and I incorporate some of their phrases, some of their values into what I'm saying. And so in that way, if the agreement feels like their input is in there and they can see it and feel it, then they take ownership of it, and it becomes a joint agreement, something that both sides value. And so that's one of my core values. It's not about me. It's about you. This is your agreement. Take ownership of it. And it's not an agreement unless both sides have worked to create it. And
if there's not buy-in, then it's called an agreement, but it isn't. You know, if there's not buy-in, if they're resigned, if the group's resigned to it, okay, with no buy-in from their perspective, then they won't support it. Then that'll cause political pressure to the board. And so part of what we need to do is solicit that buy-in and work through the process where there's a belief that they have buy-in, and it's a binding agreement, it's a bilateral agreement that represents both parties, and they have interest in there.
Yeah, I'll give it an example. Is we started off in a negotiation where we were trying to add to the leave section of a contract a procedure so that we could compel members of the bargaining unit to submit to fitness for duty examinations if they showed up to work, came back from a leave, and didn't seem like they were able to perform the job, or even if they hadn't been on a leave and we started to suspect that something was wrong with them, we wanted to be able to say, okay, we can send you to a doctor who's going to provide an analysis of whether you're fit to perform your duties. And you would think entering into a negotiation that would be something the employee union would absolutely be resisting. And so one of the things we worked on is, well, what are those situations where a member of your bargaining unit might be endangered themselves by an employee who's not fit to perform their duty. And so there's really is a mutual interest here. And also, isn't if we don't have an ability to address these issues from a more humane, medical leave standpoint, we're left to deal with the conduct that's going on from a purely disciplinary standpoint, and that's not in your interest as a bargaining unit. And so maybe we can come up with a system of checks and balances where there's, there's multiple examinations. Like if you disagree with the examination of the district selected doctor, you can get an independent third party, and so we were able basically to craft a whole procedure that the employee union felt like they had partial ownership of and saw the benefits for their members, benefits in employee safety, and frankly, they wouldn't often admit it, but when you have to work closely with an employee who may be demonstrating aspects of a mental illness or something, that makes you really stressed out to be at work. And so I think we were able to tap into a vein of mutual interest that led to the employer achieving something that they now use frequently, and the employee unions support the process.
Todd famously one time negotiated a drug testing policy with the union members. I think what sealed it was they said, listen, we'll do it for management too. And they bought into it, because I think they thought management was on drugs sometimes.
Where would they get that idea?
But it was, it was a mutual interest in something normally they'd be, a union would be aghast to agreeing to, the alcohol and drug testing procedure, but we said, listen, we'll put the same program for management, and management said, yeah, that's fine by us, and we were able to get an agreement.
Could you work for Major League Baseball next? It's going to have a little problem with that policy.
Awesome. Hey, you're not wearing orange in celebratory colors.
Yeah.
You don't know that.
The World Series win. Yeah.
All my orange clothing is in the dirty clothes.
There you go. Any malpractice or complaints that you should know about?
No. We go back and get insurance every year, and we're told that we're very, for firm our size and the work we do, have a very good record. There's absolutely nothing pending. We have to make reports every year, if anyone has any issues that might develop in the malpractice, and it's always cross your fingers, but when you have 140 lawyers, sometimes things happen. But no, we have a very good record, and our rates are relatively low compared. We're told we have a very good preventative program that hasn't been an issue.
Any other questions?
Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming in.
Well, thank you for taking the time. It's, I realize, a large chunk of it, but again, thanks for having us out.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody want to start the discussion, make a motion? John?
I move we appoint, Wiley et al. As our negotiator, and certainly consider appointing, I recognize we're not discussing the general labor role, advisory role, but this firm struck me as being very capable of doing that kind of work when that moment is appropriate. But in any event, I would support, and was very impressed by background, experience, responses, knowledge of Wiley and company, and would move.
I had a real problem with his answer about we'll negotiate in three sessions.
No. You can't agree on the shape of the table in three sessions.
Yeah, I know. And one session with the local 21.
I'd like to speak to John's motion. I realize we're not talking about the other thing, but I thought they actually had a very good answer and a candid answer about splitting business, that it's something that they could see that there'd be a distinct advantage for us in having that and keeping both firms sharp. I'd be okay with Wiley in the negotiating side, and when that issue comes up, I would consider Atkinson as the other piece of that business.
The negative to that is only when somebody says, well, that would keep us sharp, or shouldn't you always be sharp? But in reality.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I.
In reality.
It is true.
Well, I'm going to second John's motion. But I really caution us not to talk about the second firm in context with hiring for labor relations, because we haven't heard the other applicants, and we really need to start over again when we go through that process. I thought the second firm, they could handle our negotiations, but I'm more interested in going with someone who's already dealt with our two bargaining units and has relationships, and
has done this transition a number of times.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think that's good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I certainly support the motion.
Okay. And subject to contract negotiations and other items. Any other comments? All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carried. Okay. Do you want to take a quick break? And then
yes.